thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
Oh, it's halfway right there. John Hanson in for John Williams on this Wednesday afternoon. Kind of sunny Wednesday afternoon. We thought it was going to be a cloudy, dreary day across Chicago, but at least got some sunshine and temperatures getting near 70, as you heard the forecast there from Eric. John in for John on this Wednesday afternoon until 3 o'clock. Then we'll get Ro and Anna, and a lot going on this Wednesday afternoon, obviously locally with the city council and what happened in Mayor Lightfoot's first city council meeting, what she got out of it, and a really fascinating exchange with Alderman Ed Burke, who, of course, is in hot water on many different fronts. Heather Sharon from the dailyline.net is going to stop by in just a little bit, and she's going to break down everything that's happening locally. Phil Vitale always comes in at this time. We're going to do Phil's Flash Fry, my first chance to play that, which should be interesting because I'm not much of a foodie, and of course Phil is, so we'll see if he likes any of my spots. I'm beginning to think he won't. Have you heard about this traffic jam up on Mount Everest, which is literally, it's killing people. People are being stuck at the summit waiting for their chance to ascend the last 20 or 30 feet, and they're spending way more time in that thin air than they should, and they're dying on the way down just because it took so long to get up to the top. We're going to talk with Grayson Schaefer. He's an editor at Outside Magazine, and he's actually climbed Mount Everest. We're going to chat about that experience and then also explain exactly how you get a traffic jam 29,029 feet into the air. And then also got a chance to talk with two women's rugby players, rugby gaining steam and popularity across the country, especially with women. And one of them is an Olympian, going to be going to the Japan Olympics in 2020. But of course, the big news here, at least that broke a couple hours ago, was Bob Mueller's speech in front of the podium there at the Department of Justice. And it's got a lot of meat for both sides, I feel like. I know a lot of people are going to be more entrenched in their own camps after hearing what Bob Mueller had to say. Let's get through a little bit of it. So it started out, of course, he's in front of the Department of Justice seal, because until he gave that speech or shortly after, he's employed, he's paid by the Department of Justice still, until he resigns here, which he announced he'll do shortly. But he kind of outlined the scope of the investigation. We knew all of that, how it operated, what their parameters were. He made it clear, though, as to obstruction, that the report did not exonerate the president.
If we had had confidence that the president clearly did not commit a crime, we would have said so.
And that's what the report said. That's no surprising news from Bob Mueller, but it helps to have a soundbite for it for those folks that didn't read the 400 pages of the report. But that then gets to the question of charging the president. So one of the talking points that the left has been using is that, look, the only reason that the president wasn't charged with obstruction was because of that departmental policy. Those folks on the right, you would say that the attorney general testified that Bob Mueller was told, or did tell Bob Barr. Let me start over. This is getting a little too many Bobs and Bills. All right. On the right, people have said that the attorney general testified that Bob Mueller told Bill Barr that that doctrine was not the determining factor in the report's conclusion. So what did Bob Mueller say to that?
Under long-standing department policy, a president cannot be charged with a federal crime while he is in office. That is unconstitutional. Even if the charge is kept under seal and hidden from public view, that too is prohibited. The special counsel's office is part of the Department of Justice, and by regulation, it was bound by that department policy. Charging the president with a crime was therefore not an option we could consider.
Okay, so there it seems like he had his hands tied kind of before he started the investigation. But what's missing there, he's not saying that it was the sole determining factor for not charging the president. So this is kind of a wash. And like, I think this is the most unclear aspect, where whether you're on the left or on the right, a supporter or a detractor from the president, I think this is the thing that needs to be cleared up the most, is this interaction between the special counsel and the attorney general. So Bob Mueller kind of left this decision up to the attorney general, who was, of course, appointed by President Trump. And so we may never know whether Bob Mueller felt that a crime had been committed or not. There's been no public remarks from Bob Mueller himself to that effect. Bill Barr has said that Mueller told him that that was not the only reason that he didn't charge the president, but we haven't heard it from Mueller himself. So we haven't heard those questions and the answers to those questions. So some wonder, okay, well, if you can't charge the president with a crime, wouldn't the report have at least insinuated that something nefarious happened in regards to obstruction? Well, not so fast.
It would be unfair to potentially accuse somebody of a crime when there can be no court resolution of the actual charge.
So, yeah, he's kind of leaving us wide open there, too. We don't know. It muddies the water. Look, some on the right have said, look, if Bob Mueller knew that he couldn't charge the president, he would have made clear that there was strong evidence of guilt. Maybe letting Congress take it from there or let litigation in the courts after President Trump leaves office. But that's not what Bob Mueller says. He says that he wouldn't have even speculated because President Trump would not have gotten a trial and a chance to defend himself in front of a judge or a jury. So we really don't know, and maybe this is the whole point of a special prosecutor, we don't know what Bob Mueller's personal opinions as special prosecutor were. Clearly, he says that a line was not met, whether the president could be charged with obstruction or not. And I shouldn't even say clearly, that's still a little muddy, whether he says it or not. He admits that his hands were tied, but he doesn't say whether, if they were untied, if he would have been able to charge the president with everything. So we got a lot of questions for Bob Mueller, right? We're going to be able to find out more in Congress? Maybe not.
Now, I hope and expect this to be the only time that I will speak to you in this manner. I am making that decision myself. No one has told me whether I can or should testify or speak further about this matter. There has been discussion about an appearance before Congress. Any testimony from this office would not go beyond our report.
So, case closed? Are we not going to hear anything else from Bob Mueller? It seems to be saying that even if you called me, now that he's going to be a private citizen, if you call me in front of Congress, I'm just going to be regurgitating the report. You're not going to get anything more from me. So we're kind of left with where we are. You know, he spoke a lot of words that we already knew, but it does help, of course, to hear them in person in his own voice. Those are good for sound bites. So I think the right got a little bit out of this. There was no juicy sound bite. Bob Mueller didn't go rogue and say that Bill Barr had left out anything. In fact, he went to the extent of saying that Bill Barr had handled it fine. And the left is going to say, well, of course he didn't exonerate the president, and he just said that. Well, we know that, and the president's going to go ahead and say it anyways. So I think that we're just kind of left with where we started, and I don't know if we should have expected anything else. Of course, Bob Mueller is a straight shooter, a former Eagle Scout, and he likes to play it by the book. But I think each camp got a little meat, and now they're going to go back and continue to be in their own camps. And now the Democrats have a really tough decision to make. And that's is whether they want to litigate this in the House and go through an impeachment hearing, which undoubtedly he's not going to be. President Trump will never be removed from office in the Senate. Or do they just want to litigate this at the ballot box in 2020? It's an interesting question. Let's go to the phone line. Let's go to Ed. Ed, you're on WGN.
Yeah, I just don't understand what you're. This is not money whatsoever. There's a letter of the law, and that's what Bob Mueller follows.
Mm-hmm.
And he cannot bring, it's not saying that a president can't be charged with a crime. He can't be charged with a crime in a court of law, and he's the Department of Justice.
Right.
Therefore, he has to be impeached. He has given you all that he's found. He is telling you, there it is. It's laid out in front of you. Now it's time for you to run with it.
Hold on, Ed, but he's
so
not, he didn't see it.
It's time for Congress to bring the impeachment on him. And it's time for them to stand up and impeach. You got to remember, too, that Nixon was a very popular president at the time he was impeached. Maybe some of these people that will put the America before this orange clown.
Yeah. All right. I just got to ask, though, and I appreciate the phone call and the feedback. I know a lot of people feel the way you do, certainly. But Bob Mueller didn't say that. He didn't even insinuate that he has left the breadcrumbs for Congress. So that's fine that you interpret. That's fine that you interpreted that.
He's not going to say that. He's okay. Not going to say that. He's
okay.
Not going to say I left breadcrumbs or anything else. He's saying that he had an investigation.
Okay.
He can't bring. He said that the Russians were involved. He said that the president of the United States cannot be brought on criminal charges by the Department of Justice.
Right.
But it is up to the Congress, it's up to the
legislative branch. No, you're right, Ed. And here's my only point,
right,
is that you absolutely are entitled to that opinion, and a lot of congressional representatives agree with you. All I'm saying is that's now a political question. You know, that's not one for the criminal cases. And while you may have, that's your insinuation or what you believe that Bob Mueller was insinuating in leaving to the Congress, I'm just saying it's not a done deal, but we do appreciate the phone call. 312-91-7200 if you want to join the conversation. Let's go to Phil. Phil, you're on WGN.
Hello?
Hey, Phil. You're on WGN. What's your thoughts?
Yeah, my thoughts are the water isn't muddy also. I think Bob Mueller had a ability to exonerate the president, and he clearly could not do that.
Right.
That means, in his opinion, he can't charge him, but he can't clear him. So that means only the Congress could charge or convict him.
Yes, but he didn't say why he couldn't charge him. He said that his hands were tied, that he wasn't going to charge the president. But he did not say that that was the only reason why. In fact, Bill Barr has testified. Now, granted, it's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court, or excuse me, for the Attorney General's office, excuse me. But he is not saying that that is the only reason why he didn't charge the president. He's just saying that.
I agree with that also. But my point is, if he could have exonerated him, as he did in the collusion first volume,
right,
he would have done that.
Right.
So we clearly know that he could not clear the president of obstruction. And
true.
If he could have, he would have.
True.
There's nothing stopping him from doing that except the evidence he went through didn't allow him to do that.
Right. It's just
I don't see how the right can take much from that.
No, I agree. But what I'm saying is the right can take that they didn't get some juicy soundbite saying Bob Mueller saying, hey, the only reason I didn't charge him is because I couldn't. Someone else should do this. You may infer that that's what he's saying, but he didn't give you that soundbite. So.
Well, and the other question I'd raise is, I think Bill Clinton was impeached for lying about Monica Lewinsky.
Yeah, for perjury.
And we all knew he lied. And then when he says, Mueller report exonerated me, we all know he lied.
Mm-hmm.
I think that puts him in a very poor position.
Phil, we appreciate the phone call. Thanks so much. Let's go to line one. Mike, you're on WGN.
Yeah, hi. I would disagree with you very strongly. He said, of course, he could not indict him because of the Department of Justice guidelines.
Right.
And he could not exonerate him. So that means is that if he weren't the president, he would have indicted him. There's no other way to look at that. And the next step is for Congress to look and see if President Trump is a fit president or if his lying and obstructions of justice is something beyond the pale for America. And the whole idea that he didn't have enough evidence to bring collusion charges, even though collusion wasn't the crime, is because the people he wanted to speak to would not speak to him. And this constant drumbeat that Don Jr. spent hours testifying is not true, and that President Trump spent hours testifying is not true. He said 30 times on the written statement he did not recall conversations.
Right.
So he could not have enough evidence to bring conspiracy charges because he could not get anyone to be honest with him.
Right.
And that leads to the obstruction charges. And Bob Mueller is saying they obstructed justice. The Department of Justice won't let me charge him. And if I had said I will indict him with a sealed indictment, Bob Mueller found that unfair.
Yeah.
For anyone, for unfair to the person charged. He said it would be unfair to charge President Trump when he could not answer the charges
right.
in court.
But he didn't.
And since court is denied to us, I will not do this. So the next step for justice is the Congress to look and see if this is the president that should lead us.
Okay.
In this global struggle.
Hold on, Mike.
Hold on, Mike.
You're right in where he says that I didn't have enough evidence to charge, or I could not charge him because he was the president. But he's not saying that was
right.
the sole reason. And then the next, you're adding
what
words in his mouth
what
for the end of
it. You
you're adding
what
words at the end of the, they're adding hit words in his mouth at the end of this. He did not say, now Congress should take the ball and run with it. That is your own interpretation.
Yes, he did. That's not my interpretation. He said the next steps, he referred to the next steps. And if you look at the law and the way it's structured, and if you look at the person who actually wrote this new revised statute, it's a report to Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Mueller wrote a report to Congress, not to the Attorney General.
No.
To the President.
Bob Mueller wrote the report to the Attorney General. The Attorney General was then at his own discretion whether he wanted to give it to Congress or not. In fact, Mueller complimented Bill Barr for releasing the whole almost the whole thing.
Again, if you see what we're used to now, we're used to the debate being screaming and broad strokes, and you're a liar, this and that. Bob Mueller's an old school guy,
yeah.
And what he's saying is he's using decorum and nuance, and he's trusting us to be smart enough to look at what he said.
That's fine.
He said, "I can't do this. I was prescribed from doing this. The next step is Congress."
All right. Well, I appreciate the phone call, Mike. I got to let you go because we got to go to a commercial break. I do appreciate all the feedback and everyone interacting here, but I think that what we've got here is a case where that a lot of people are taking that next step for Bob Mueller, but that isn't exactly what Bob Mueller said. And I think that this is just going to end up being a situation that needs to be litigated in the 2020 election, and nothing beyond that. 720 WGN. Oh, we're off to a start here. John Hanson in for John Williams. I'm being called, I should go to Fox News and be a host. I'm being called a troll for the right wing. I've only voted a Republican once. I am a left-leaning liberal Democrat, and I just do not have the gymnastics to be able to take the steps and the hoops that other people on the left seem to be able to take towards what Bob Mueller said. I appreciate his decorum and his steady hands. He did not say that he knows the president obstructed justice. He simply says that his hands were tied either way, but he never truly revealed how he felt about that. And maybe he shouldn't. And he said that the reason why he wouldn't speculate is because if he did speculate, then President Trump would not have a chance in court to defend himself.
But he did say if I thought he didn't do it, I'd tell you.
Right, but we're talking this is not a court of law, though.
Right.
He is looking at this from a prosecutorial situation. So, yes, he's looking for that burden of proof to be met before he's the burden.
There never was a burden of proof because he said we could never charge him
right.
No matter what.
This is why I'm saying.
But then he also said, but if I thought he didn't do it, I'd tell you.
Right.
I mean, that's why it's so.
Yeah, but you agree it's muddy. Like, I don't think it's clear as Bob Mueller saying, oh, I think he did it, but I couldn't tell you because I'm not supposed to, and we're not going to charge him anyway,
well,
so what's the point?
It's hugely frustrating, but, I mean, just, you know, I don't care what way it comes out, just say it. But if you say, I'd tell you if I didn't think he did it, but I can't tell you he did it. You know, I mean,
right.
if you're coming down one side or the other,
yeah.
You know,
I guess I'm just not ready to make that leap yet. And I guess it doesn't matter. And like, what's going to happen next? Now it's a political discussion about whether the House should take this up or not.
Well,
and
Nadler just spoke a few minutes ago and said he's ruling nothing out. But,
yeah.
You know, if the administration continues just to play ball, there's not much they can do.
Right. They got to. The House has to stand up for its rights to be able to have oversight and call subpoenas and get people in front of them. But as far as impeachment, yeah, it's really easy for reps on the far left to be able to say, in real blue districts, to say, let's impeach Donald Trump. But Nancy Pelosi knows better. She won the House. She won 40 seats in basically suburban districts, which split down the middle. And if you put those House members on order and they have to choose impeachment or not, she's going to have real problems keeping that gavel in 2020. Anyways, believe it or not, we're going to try and squeeze in one quick topic. Heather Sharon from the dailyline.net. Heather, we went off the rails. I apologize. How are you doing this afternoon?
I'm good, John. I'm glad that I wasn't in the hot seat for that.
No, it's okay. I like being in the hot seat. Heather, we'll break this down here a little bit more later on. But for the most part today, what a fascinating meeting today at City Council.
It really was. It was Mayor Lori Lightfoot's first City Council meeting, and it started with a literal bang of a gavel and a lot of fireworks between her and Alderman Ed Burke.
Yeah, she told him to sit down not once but twice, right?
That's right. So the big debate was over the rules that will govern the City Council for the next 4 years, as well as the initial slate of committee chairs. And as Mayor Lightfoot was getting ready to sort of start the process of approving those, Alderman Ed Burke rose from his seat and lodged an objection. And what he said was that he objected to the fact that the rules did not include gender-neutral language, mm-hmm. and that they refer to city officials as being him or his or, you know, all of those male pronouns. And Mayor Lightfoot was not amused. She basically said, look, it makes no difference under the law. Those terms can refer to ever who holds the office. You're out of order. If I am interested in hearing you speak again, I will call on you.
Wow.
Yes. And eventually, he was one of three aldermen that voted no on these committee chairs. He was joined by Alderman Raymond Lopez of the 15th Ward and Alderman Anthony Beal of the 9th Ward. Now, there might have been another no vote tossed in there, but we don't know because it wasn't a roll call.
It was a
voice vote. But we do know that Alderman Lopez objected to the way Lightfoot put together the slate of committee chairs. He has also been very critical of her attempts to roll back and end aldermanic prerogative, which gives each alderman the authority to determine what happens in his or her ward. So it was really the start of a brand new era, because under Mayor Rahm Emanuel, until he was charged with attempted extortion, which he says he is innocent of, Alderman Ed Burke presided over the city council along with the mayor and routinely spoke for upwards of 10, 15 minutes on whatever subject caught his fancy. So this is a stark, stark turnaround.
It's a new administration, it's a new city council, and this is a new record for us, Heather, our shortest interview ever. Heather, at thedailyline.net, I can't wait to see your coverage of this, and I know it's going to be good. Thanks for joining us, even just for a short amount of time.
Thanks, John.
WGN, John Hanson in for John Williams until 3 o'clock, then Ro and Anna, of course, and they'll be talking more about the Bob Mueller stuff as well. I wanted to take one more quick call on that. Let's go to Paul. Paul, you're on WGN. Paul, you there?
Hey, John.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yes, John. Yeah, a lot of comments about what Mueller might have said or not said, but right. One of the things I heard him say was he couldn't charge a sitting president, and that word has been missing from the discussion, and I think that opens up a whole realm of possibility once Mr. Trump is no longer in office.
Oh, certainly. I think the 2020 election is going to be one that the president not only wins to continue his administration, but one he wins because he's going to be afraid of facing prosecution from other districts across the country.
Yeah, I think, I think that's the vulnerability, yeah. And I was just kind of, I thought it was kind of interesting that everybody's focusing on what happens right now or impeachment, but the fact that he did not exonerate him opens up a whole criminal proceeding possibility once he's no longer a sitting president.
Yeah, and that's the key, once he's no longer a sitting president. We appreciate the call, Paul. Man, I have never made so many liberals so upset at a fellow Democrat as I did today, but there's people telling me I should be a shill for Fox News today, which I've never heard before. The only thing more that gets people riled up than discussions about politics is discussions about food, and Phil Vitale from the Tribune, thanks for coming in today, as always.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
It's nice to meet you officially. I know you're here with John Williams usually at this time slot, and I got to say I'm looking forward to this, Phil, because I am probably the least foodie person that is out there.
I see.
But I still... Where you say you see is in like you looked
right.
at me.
I thought you looked
me up and down.
I understand
said, oh.
Exactly. No wonder.
Yeah, but
no wonder you're in shape. You're not eating enough.
But I always enjoy reading your reviews. And
thank you.
The one that we wanted to talk about today, the one food that I will go a little foodie on because I spent some time living on the boot, is Italian food. And you had a great review out. Tell us about the joint that you reviewed just recently.
Next has been around for, 7 years now.
Mm-hmm.
Three times a year, they completely change their format. Just they'll go, their first ever menu was called Paris 1906. And they followed cookbooks by Escoffier and just fashioned a thing like that. A few years back, they did something called Ancient Rome, where they took, they found ancient writing, a book, a collection of ancient recipes, and as best they could, recreated or reinterpreted those.
That's cool.
Back then, measurements were just like, take some of this and take some of that, you know, add this.
Is that why it's called Next? Because it's just like, because all right, what's new? What's next?
Right, well, because, and also because it was the next, the following concept to Alinea. Which is the same people.
Yeah.
So that's what came next.
Okay.
And this time they just did Italia, which makes sense. They do three menus. This is the basically the summer menu, and they usually find something that's maybe a little more accessible, a little more fun, and one that's that best plays for the season because you start the menu, say, now, and what's available in the market now is going to be completely different in 6 weeks, and it's going to change again in another 6 weeks because it's a time of great change when the tomatoes come in, and the, right now the morels are in, they're on their way out, and things like that. So they put together a menu just celebrating Italian, Italia, Italy, and in a certain extent, Italian-American cooking.
Did they focus on a certain region of Italy?
No, they've done that in the past. They did a Sicily menu in their third year out. But this year, they just went with just the cuisine itself, which is either really plenty of room to experiment or enough room to hang yourself, depending on how you do it.
Oh, right, exactly. You take a leap like that and you give yourself the whole breadth of the island, or to the island, the boot, you could get in real trouble. I will say, this is just a quick aside, so I got to study abroad in northern Italy, Verona, when I was in college. And I went there thinking I was going to get all spaghetti and meatballs and meat sauce because that's what I grew up on. And I was sorely disappointed that it's so much fish and so much seafood on the menus. Obviously, it was only an hour west of Venice, so I guess it made sense. But I didn't think of that before I went.
Right. I mean, Italy is so long that so when you get up to the area that's closer to Switzerland, the menu changes a lot more. They're actually raising some beef and they're doing a lot of cheese up there, and not so much tomatoes that you find further. And so, yeah, it used to be 30 years ago, if you asked, you said you were going to an Italian menu restaurant, you would they'd say, "Oh, well, is it Northern Italian or Southern Italian?" And they'd want to know because it would inform it. And now everything is such a there's so much crossover that it doesn't matter anymore.
Anything specific you recommend if we're going to stop by next? Or?
Well, next you just sign up for the whole menu. Yeah, that's what you do.
Well, that's nice.
But they start off right away. They just let you know you're in for something a little different. They have their antipasti course, which everybody has an antipasti course. But then all of a sudden, 6, 7, 8 plates drop down on your table, and they just cover everything. So, you'll have little bits of crostini here with the three different kinds with different their toppings, like tapenade and or a veal tongue on top of one, and broccoli rabe with garlic on the other. And then over there's some fried zucchini blossoms that have been deep fried, but they're topped with a little caviar because this is next after all, and they're telling you we're doing it the big way. There's a little bit of fluke crudo, a little raw fish over there, a little bit of some pan-roasted scampi, and all of this, and then the big loaf of focaccia with a big bowl of burrata cheese.
Oh, man, now you got me.
Yeah, that's the first course. You know, got 8 more to go, you might want to pace yourself, too late.
Yeah.
And then they throw in then they'll throw in one pasta course and then cut over to a different fish and then back to a double pasta course because they're trying to recreate the the idea of family style dining.
Yeah,
you know, because in a lot of restaurants and even at home, when pasta comes out, it's not one pasta, it's a couple of pastas, two big bowls,
scoop
and you pass them around.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's what they did here with two different ones. And the ones they did were cool, but they're not going to be the same tonight.
Really?
So every
couple of nights or every night they change it on
up? They change it up. And then they'll probably be a huge revamp in a few weeks when, if nothing else, the mushrooms they're using now are not going to be around and new mushrooms are coming in. So you'll have a little of that and a little less of that. And yeah, this is the kind of menu that they get to play with.
How many courses did we get through? I just lost count.
I think we got 8 or 9. It depends on what you think. I think it's 9, although I counted as 8 because the last two desserts arrive at the same time.
Oh, okay.
So that's just
one joint
course.
In
it's
one.
Still two desserts, though.
And you ordered the whole menu there. How much does that set you back? That's always what I'm looking at when I'm looking at a restaurant.
This is one of the most expensive restaurants around.
Wow.
In this case, well, they because they're on this online system known as TOC, they're able to change the price depending on the day.
Oh, really?
So if you go midweek,
yeah,
the meal would be say $145.
Yeah,
same meal on a Saturday night prime time is going to be $185.
Wow. So that's a disadvantage if you're looking to go out on one of those prime time nights, but that does give you a possibility on one of the weeknights.
It makes it a lot more accessible, and it's actually very clever. Like anything else, there are lots of other businesses that if you show up on off hours, you're going to get a bit of a break.
Yeah,
and that's how they play it here too.
Mm-hmm.
And that depends on. And then there's also, that's the basic, and then there's a kitchen table. They only seat it once, maybe twice in a night, and that'll hold about 6 or 8 people, and you book that. That's going to be a little more expensive mm-hmm. because you get stuff at the kitchen table
that
nobody gets over there. You get more stuff.
Oh.
And then there's the
because after 9 courses, I'd want a little bit more stuff.
A little bit more.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, what, 9 courses?
Yeah,
that's all I'm getting? And then there's also one for us for smaller parties where you just have your own room and they just take care of you. And that's going to be a little more expensive, too. Mm-hmm. But, you know. You got your own room.
Some drinking, too, I associate with this, probably.
Yes, yes. They have different tastes. They have tastings. They have tastings at 4 levels. There is what they call the water tasting,
okay.
Which is free. Thank you
yes,
very much.
That's wonderful.
And then there's a non-alcoholic. And then there's usually 2 or 3 different wine flights or sometimes a combination of wine and cocktail or whatever, but you know, beverage pairings is more sensible than just assuming it's a wine pairing.
Man, the growth in flights, whether it's wine or beer, has such been a great thing for restaurants to do because I'm always someone that, you know, just likes a little bit of each one. I don't know which one I'm going to pick, and if I hate it, I'm going to be like, oh, God, I ordered the bottle or at least even a whole glass sometimes.
Right.
I got to get through that.
Or you've got a bottle that works great with that veal,
right.
And you still got some left over, and now comes a course that's not so great with.
Right.
So sometimes, especially when in a place such as Next, when I'm not exactly sure what's coming, and I should mention, you don't get the menu at the start of the meal.
Oh, wow.
You
so you don't know.
You get the menu at the end of the meal.
That's
so
recap.
You can remember what you had. You can take that back with you, but they don't give you anything to start. You just sit there and stuff just starts to happen.
Here's a little of a foodie I am. I'll just order when I'm at a sushi place. I'll just point to a bunch of things. I have no idea what it is. And if mm-hmm. you were to lay them all out in front of me, I would never be able to tell you which one was which.
Right. Well, once it's cut up, it's pretty darn hard.
It's true. Okay. So you're making me feel better.
Yeah. I mean, salmon is pretty clearly salmon.
Right.
And some of the others. But, you know, you get a piece of fluke. It's translucent.
It's pretty
obvious, yes. You can see. I can see myself. I can see through this practically.
Yeah.
So, yeah, no, I'm not going to know for sure it's fluke. I mean, there's certain fish that always show up all the time. So,
right.
You know, it's like it's salmon, tuna, hamachi, yellowtail. Okay, those are your sacred quartet that's mm-hmm. going to show up in any collection. And then they throw in a few other things. But it's always nice to, what's fun with me, because, of course, Chicago Tribune pays for my meals,
right, yes.
Which is way fun.
Yeah,
is
that's
to
super
just,
fun.
Is just require, is just request omakase, which is when the chef just
surprises you.
He just gives you stuff.
Where's Next at again? For those that are
Next
wondering,
Next is at is in the Fulton Market District. Of course, one of the early arrivals out there. Actually, it's 953 West, which is the actual address, but it is essentially the corner of Morgan and Fulton Market.
That's right over there by the new L stop there too. All right, now's your chance to call or text in for Phil's Flash Fry. I'm excited to play this with your favorite dishes and restaurants in Chicago, and Phil will give you his take on those dishes and choice spots. Oh, there we go. There we go.
My vegetables, I'm gonna chop down my vegetables. I love you most of all, my favorite.
720 WGN, this is Phil's Flash Fry. Phil, have you ever like gotten a call from one of our viewers? And by the way, they can all chime in, 312-981-7200. And you said, oh, after you heard about it, you're like, I have got to check that out. And you go ahead and
sure.
do it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. yeah. No, it doesn't happen. People
so you
say,
look at this as homework in sort of a way.
Right. I look at it as people doing my homework for me. That's what that's how I look at it.
312-981. Is it just city or is it city and suburbs?
City
too?
And suburbs. Tell Phil where to go and be careful with your first answer.
Right. You know, one of my favorite places, this might be so below your level, Phil, I don't even know, is one of my favorite burgers in town. I used to live in the West Ukrainian Village. Fatso's Last Stand.
Oh, yeah. That
on Chicago Avenue.
Yeah. That's a friend of mine used to work near there, and her entire staff would send out for Fatso's on one day a week, and they just send whoever's lowest on the totem pole said go get them,
yes. go get a
bring
bunch
them back
Fatso's.
And don't take too much time because mm-hmm. I want them warm.
815 chimes in the Carolina pork from Pearl's Southern Comfort in Edgewater.
Oh, okay.
All right.
Yeah, that's a nice place. So which?
I think the place is called Pearl Southern Comfort.
Right.
It's over in the Edgewater neighborhood.
And what was the dish you
recommended? Carolina pork.
Oh, nice.
So I imagine maybe a pulled pork with Carolina sauce, maybe?
Right. It's which is going to be a little more vinegary than the tangy, sweet Memphis-style sauce that Chicagoans like or are accustomed to.
I love a good... If I'm going to choose between pulled pork, you know, when you choose your sauces for a sandwich, I'm always going Carolina. I love that vinegar. Mm-hmm. Love the little...
First time I was in the Carolinas, asked for barbecue, and they said, I said, okay, well, let's get some barbecue.
Uh-huh.
I said, where's the bones? He says, well, there's no bones in barbecue. Okay. And where's the tomato sauce? There's no tomato sauce.
Right.
This is Carolina barbecue. It's like, what, well, doesn't go on a grill? No, it doesn't go on a grill. It goes in a smoker.
It's a smoker, exactly.
What is the matter
with
you?
For like a day and a half or something like that. 312-981-7200. Get your picks in. Okay, I got to ask, we're talking about barbecue. Do you ever been down to Champaign-Urbana? You ever make your way down there?
Sure, Interstate 57? My wife did her... Her doctorate work down there, so I goes there quite a bit.
There's a place called Black Dog Barbecue. It's in Urbana. Now they just opened up a new place in Champaign, too.
Ooh.
Get anything you want there, but the tips are going to be the best you've had, I can promise you, Phil.
I guess that's recent. I'm guessing. My older boy graduated from U of I around 2009.
Yeah, it's right around then.
About the last time I was there for the graduation.
I just said 2 hours south on 57. You'll get it. You keep on going at 57. I've always wondered about this. You've been down to Memphis for barbecue, Phil?
Yeah.
Can you tell we're in my wheelhouse now with barbecue? Right. It's like the one thing I know about?
No, Memphis is a great town for that. The first time I was down there, took the kids. They were pretty young, and we just got to our hotel, and it just the skies just opened. It was just coming down in sheets, but there was a barbecue place right across the street. So mm-hmm. that was our pick for the day. So one of us drowned, went out there and got the blanking on the name, but they had red, white, and blue part of their logo. It was one of the big three, Corky's.
Corky's.
That was my first exposure to Corky's. Their first exposure to pulled pork, and they fell in love.
That's just a good
right
start
there on the floor of the Holiday Inn, while the skies. Poor,
yeah, exactly. 312-981-7200. Call or text on in. I also saw on the trip, I saw a couple of your picks in there. You guys did reviews of Small Bites, which a bunch of appetizer courses. I don't know if they just put together.
Yeah, we've been doing it all month. Yeah. One feature a day. And mm-hmm. we sent the whole team goes out, so everybody kicks in. I did like maybe two.
Yeah, I
and
saw the two.
Everybody else did everything else, so it was great.
Nachos is more my speed. Let's go to Tony. Tony, how's it going?
Hey, good. Hey, just heard you mention Black Dog. I'm calling from Champaign, Urbana. While you're coming down this way, you might as well have the best Chicago pizza, too, while you're down here.
Ah, and where is it at? Is it called?
That's Papadel's.
Phil, come on. You got to know Papadel's.
Yeah, that's been... Yeah, that's when I was down in Champaign.
Yeah, right.
Going to Papa Del's. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, go ahead, Tony.
I had Pequot's for the first time a month and a half ago, and I tell you what, it's got nothing on Papa Del's.
I would agree with that, but that's my own personal
Other than
opinion.
Being extremely overpriced.
Tony, thanks so much for the phone call. We appreciate it. Got a text from Berwyn. Smoked chicken wings, cigars and stripes. So I bet the place is called Cigars and Stripes in Berwyn. Smoked chicken wings.
Well, I've been to Berwyn recently, but I'm not familiar with Cigars and Stripes. Mm-hmm. Great name for a restaurant. And smoked chicken wing. Well, if you're going to smoke the cigars, you might as well smoke the meat as well, right?
I agree with that. Let's go to Sue. Sue, what do you got for Phil here?
Hey, I'd love him to venture out to the way to the northwest side at 5310 West Devon, City's Edge, for the best barbecue. Great smoked pulled pork, chicken, and brisket's fantastic.
I got to ask Sue, do you run City's Edge? You said you had that pitch ready to go.
Oh, no, I don't, but I am. It's my son.
Ah, that's wonderful.
Personal. Okay.
You're a good mom.
Yeah, there you go. All right, thank you so much, Sue. Got another text. Heading to KC, Kansas City for the weekend. Seeking any Phil suggestions if he has them. Favorite barbecue joint in Kansas City if you made it down there.
I have. Now, I'm blanking on what there was a... There was a place that had something. It has the number 39 in it.
Okay.
Something 39. It's a little more. It's so nice inside that you start thinking this can't be authentic. Mm-hmm. I'm way too comfortable.
Right.
It's way too clean. I'm not happy. But they do very good Q, and I am absolutely addicted to their sauce, and what's driving me nuts is that they don't sell outside their own restaurant.
So it's just there.
I can call, I can mail, but no, I can't get. You got to be there to get it.
Google it. Something something 39 yeah. in Casey. And the last one I'll give you, a small place in Highland Park, Onion Garden. Great healthy food. Szechuan. How do I say that? Szechuan sauce.
Szechuan.
On their wellness plates. Also many vegan options.
Phil. Yeah, sounds like it with Onion Garden. So it's all vegetarian.
I don't know. They didn't say that. But they say a lot of vegan options. So there you go. Phil, it's always great when you stop by. Thanks for coming in, even when it's a pinch hitter. I appreciate it.
I was glad to do it.
And you got some homework for yourself.
Thinking big thoughts so you don't have to. Here's John Williams.
John Hanson in for John Williams on this busy Wednesday afternoon across Chicago. It's 2:08 now on WGN. And turned out to be a pretty nice afternoon, at least downtown. We're seeing these clear skies. The earlier clouds are out of the way. And what, I think we got another 12 hours before it might rain heavily again and storm heavily again. It doesn't look like a great day tomorrow, as you heard Steve Bertrand just mention. By the way, I forgot to wrap up that thing with Phil Vitale when we were talking about great barbecue in Kansas City. Phil was talking about, Phil's flash fry, and someone asked about where to get great barbecue in Kansas City. And he couldn't remember the name of the place he loved. And one of the texters helped out, Q39. It's a little place. And Phil loved their barbecue sauce. Also, BB Lawnside, like a BB gun, and Lawnside. And Arthur Bryant's. Those were his recommendations if you're heading to Kansas City.
I think I've been to Arthur Bryant's.
Really? Yeah, he said that was like the big one in town. So, and luckily, it seems like, speaking of Kansas City, man, that tornado that touched down southwest of Kansas City, I think between Lawrence and Kansas City last night. I never quite understand, and maybe a helicopter pilot will tell me why, but Steve, you ever watch how the news crews actually shoot those tornadoes? I know they're further away than they look, but man, getting up in a helicopter in front of a storm seems like the worst place to be.
I did not see that, no.
Yeah, they put up the news choppers and they give them shots of the tornado, and I know that having been a traffic reporter in the sky on and off for some time, I know that the pilots are safe and that never seems like the safest place to be, but it gives us incredible footage. And thankfully, the thing kind of dissipated before it hit Kansas City. But I digress. Let's go to the other side of the world and talk about Mount Everest. Man, what a crazy story about kind of the last place you'd expect to find a traffic jam would be 29,000 feet in the air, and that's where Mount Everest is. But so many people wanting to climb it, and the permits becoming more and more accessible, perhaps too much so. So joining us now to talk about that is Grayson Schaefer. He's the editor at Outside Magazine. Grayson, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
So, Grayson, you've been to Everest, but I don't know if you've climbed all the way up it, but I wonder if you could kind of paint a picture, either based on your memory or photos you've seen, about what exactly is happening at the top of Mount Everest right now.
Well, I spent a couple of years there reporting on this phenomenon of crowds on Everest, and essentially what you have is about, 1,000 or 2,000 people living in base camp in this kind of Burning Man-like city that is erected out of nowhere each spring around this time.
When you say base camp, well, we're talking about what, 10, like elevation 10,000 feet? Where are we at in terms of...
We're talking about elevation 17,600 feet. So there's no town there. It's just at the foot of... It's at the foot of the Khumbu Glacier. There's, huge yellow wall tents and personal tents and cook tents and latrine tents. It's kind of this mobile city that springs up out of the moraine each mm-hmm. year, and this year the Nepalese government issued 380 or so climbing permits to what are called team members, who are the sort of Westerners who come and pay to climb the mountain. And then in addition to those, there'll be another 300 to 700 support Sherpas, who are the local indigenous community, who are sort of world renowned as strong climbers who help these guys get to the top.
How much does a permit cost, by the way?
So the permits on the Nepalese side are $11,000, which is actually pretty inexpensive for something like this. And then in order to actually reach the summit is anywhere from $25,000 to about $100,000, depending on the level of service that you're asking for, and showers and helicopter rides back into town, that kind of stuff.
How much of a window do you have? I didn't realize there was even a season for this, but that seems to make sense. How long of a window do they have to get all these couple hundreds of people up and down?
So each year, the jet stream backs off, and there's this sort of narrow window of time, usually between around May 5th and the end of June, when the jet stream backs off, the winds calm down, and before the sort of huge monsoons and thunderstorms come in June, when the weather is actually calm and clear enough for climbers to reach the summit. And this year, this is where the problems are coming from, is that the weather windows have been extraordinarily narrow this year, and so all 380 of those permitted climbers and their Sherpas who are helping them get to the top are all sort of trying to rush the summit in the same 12 to 24 hour weather window. So it just creates a bottleneck that the mountain just can't accommodate that number of people trying to reach the summit all at the same time.
I have a lot of strange questions I hope you can help me out with. But so let's say you're at base camp, you're at 17,000 feet, you're trying to get about another 12,000 feet up. How long is that journey? Like, are there other stops along the way to camp out for the night? Okay.
So one of the biggest obstacles is the Khumbu Icefall, which is just between base camp and Camp 1 at about 19,100 feet or 19,500 feet. The icefall is one of the most dangerous places. That's where you see these photos of people walking across these teetering ladders and all of that sort of thing. People will typically go up to Camp 1, Camp 2 at 22,000 feet, and they'll do these rotations where they're just going up and spending time at higher altitude, allowing their bodies to acclimatize to the higher elevations. There's Camp 3 at about 23,000 feet. Camp 4 is on what's called the South Col, right at about 24,000 feet, which is right about the 8,000-meter mark. Mm-hmm. And that's where that's sort of the beginning of what they call the death zone, which is once you're up there, your body can no longer acclimatize. You're not actually, getting stronger by staying there. You're actually dying a little bit with every hour that you're spending there. So people generally will go up and they'll maybe spend a night at the South Col or maybe only spend a night at Camp 3. And then once they've done that, they go back down to base camp, they rest up, and then they go for their summit push, which is usually a 3 or 4 day affair where they'll go up and stay at Camp 2, go either stay at Camp 3 or Camp 4, and then leave it at somewhere between midnight and 2 a.m. The night of their summit push, climb through the night, try to summit usually around dawn, and then get off the mountain before the afternoon weather moves in.
So just to recap, and I hope people are following at home. I mean, I know it's a lot to kind of walk through. So they ascend as high as they can go to get more acclimated until they get just south of the death zone. They get their bodies as strong as they can to the point where if they went any higher, it would just weaken them over time. They go back to base camp and then slowly head up the whole thing, and then they try and do that last push in one day. They are in one overnight into the next morning.
Yeah, one long day. And so the thing that complicates all this is that, it used to be that people would sort of try to roll the dice and read the tea leaves and figure out exactly when they were going to, try their, send their expedition on the summit bid. And in the olden days, these expeditions would be sort of national teams, trying to plant the flag for their country. And there would be the 10 best alpinists from, choose your country that hasn't been to Everest yet.
Right.
At this point, the thing is that the weather forecasting is actually really good. The supercomputers have gotten really good, and the people who read them at the Swiss forecasting companies have gotten really good. The problem is that everybody gets the same results from those forecasts. So everybody sees these weather windows opening up, and it becomes kind of like a dinner bell where everybody knows that they're all going to try and rush the first big summit window all at the same time.
It really looks like people are in line, and not to make light of this, because I know people are dying from this, but the line looks long enough. It looks like you're lining up for a roller coaster or something like that. I know it's way tougher than that. When you're climbing up, how much time does the average human body, even one that's been conditioned in the way that these bodies have been conditioned at this point, I mean, what's your time window to wait up there?
People are trying to get onto and off of the summit, usually in under 12 hours. Once you start to get into noon of the following day, people will have brought multiple sort of scuba tank like oxygen containers to help them breathe the air at that altitude. The problem with carrying with being on the oxygen is that when that oxygen runs out, your body's not acclimatized at all to try to breathe the air above 25,000 feet without supplemental oxygen.
It's scary.
So, the people who run out of oxygen, they're not just running out of oxygen and then, you know, they're going down, and it's sort of a compounding factor. It creates a compounding factor where things like hypothermia, I mean, you know, oxygen is one of the things that helps you heat your body. So hypothermia, sluggish decision making, cerebral edema, where you start to get water swelling on your brain. All of these factors start to compound really quickly when people start to get into distress. So it's something where somebody seems a little bit slow, like they're sitting down too often, or, you know, just not moving very fast. That can compound into unconsciousness, you know,
very quickly,
especially if, you know, if you're with some of the Sherpas who are less experienced, who don't know the signs to look for, rather than being with some of the guys who have been up there for 20 years, or some of the Western guides who have been guiding it for 20 years, who are really good and are really good at recognizing the symptoms.
When you are kind of, when we see these pictures of these lines, that's not only the way up, because it's the same rope up and down at the tippy top, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's like trying, you know, imagine, you know, trying to get on and off the subway at rush hour. I mean, these people are trying to pass each other, going both directions on this one narrow line, and having to unclip and reclip around people and do this sort of delicate shimmy. It's definitely a huge mess.
How long do you get when you're at the top? Because here's the thing: if I'm standing in line and I'm in trouble, you know, but you want to like hurry the person up front of you that gets up to the top. But at the same time, you just got 29,029 feet. I imagine you want to take some photos. I mean, that's got to be a struggle.
It's like getting to one of those, you know, crowded view spots at Yosemite or something like that. It's really interesting. And that, you know, the summit of Mount Everest, the flat part where you can actually stand on it, is, you know, is only the size of a large dinner table. And, you know, you have sort of this one small opportunity, both for your safety and for people waiting to try and get their own photos. But, you know, you can get up there and people will spend, you know, 5 or 10 minutes trying to get, you know, get their selfies. But, you know, for people who get up there, there's that old saying, you know, pics or it didn't count, and you got to get, you know, people want to get their photos. And at the same time, the summit is getting crowded. People are having to wait in line just to get their photos. And that's adding another, you know, 10 or 20 minutes to the amount of time that people are spending, or some might say wasting, in that death zone.
I imagine for some people here on the ground, it's easy to say, oh, you know, you get up to that point, you don't feel great, you're risking your life, you got to go back down. And I imagine that's what some people do. But also at the same time, imagine you've got 5 or 10 more people to you, or 20, or whatever the case may be. You've gone so far. Is that, I imagine that's a struggle that people go through to make those decisions.
Yeah, I think that the decision making at that altitude is really the thing that people struggle with the most. It's, you know, you put so much time and effort. People have taken off, you know, months of their careers. They put, you know, $25,000 to $100,000. Some people are well healed and run their own businesses and can just write a check for it. Some people have done Kickstarter campaigns, and, you know, it runs the gamut of people from, you know, people who are just living out a childhood dream to people who are
Mandy Moore. I don't know,
like doing an Ironman.
I don't know if you saw
Mandy Moore. Mandy Moore was not trying to climb it on. She was just going to on a trek to base camp. But at the same time, I mean, the mountain has a way of you know, captivates people and has for years, and people see it as a sort of lifelong bucket list kind of event, and you know, will go to incredible lengths and put themselves at risk to reach the top.
Is there any thought about limiting the number of permits? Although at the same time, for a lot of these locals, this is a big source of revenue for them.
Yeah, I mean, limiting the number of permits would definitely help. The Chinese have limited the number of permits on the north side of the mountain, and as a result, you know, you haven't read anything about traffic jams or catastrophes on the north side, and yet this phenomenon of blue sky deaths, you know, people dying in good weather on the south side, I mean, you could write this same exact story every single year for the last 10 years on the south side of Everest. So yeah, limiting permits would help, requiring some kind of prerequisite climbing resume, you know, requiring people to climb another 8,000 meter peak like Choyo-Yu or one of the other kind of stepping stone peaks that people often climb before attempting Everest would help. But, you know, the Nepalese government and the Ministry of Tourism and Civil Aviation has shown almost no willingness to actually take those steps to regulate the industry, to make it safer. And ultimately, I mean, it definitely would be a hit for some of the local companies and some of the Sherpas who make a good living by guiding clients if they weren't able to guide as many people. But at the same time, it would probably be safer for them, because ultimately, you know, as many of them or more die each year trying to help Westerners and trying to rescue Westerners or just trying to carry their equipment and oxygen bottles up the mountain than the Westerners themselves.
I had a few questions on the text line about how you get down. I think we talked about that single file rope for part of the way down. Even a caller was asking earlier, why not, you know, install some sort of emergency zip line down or something? But I imagine it's a matter of, it's hard enough to get human beings to walk up there, let alone to put any infrastructure. And I imagine there's laws, limitations, and that just isn't feasible, right?
Yeah, trying to put some kind of zip line down. I mean, it's not a direct line down. It's a difficult sort of roundabout way of, you know, people having to walk down every step, retracing every step that they've taken. You know, there's a famous old saying in mountaineering that the summit is only halfway, and you know, the descent is the only part that is not optional.
Yeah.
There was a case a handful of years ago where there was somebody who was gonna try to wingsuit off the summit. There have been people who have parachuted off the summit, but ultimately, you know, the only way for you know, 380 paying guided clients to get off the summit is for them to walk down just the way they came up.
It's amazing that, you know, something like this, which of course wasn't even scaled and topped, no one got on top, or at least no non-natives got up top to like the 50s or something like that. And then, you know, people think, oh, you know, it's so easy, I can do it, you know, then people have been trained to do it. But then, you know, the mountain strikes back in a way, you know, like, I mean, there is still a limitation. It is not something, it's not a necessarily the most touristy thing that anyone's going to be able to do. In fact, can you put into context just really quickly before we let you go is how many people have died climbing Mount Everest? Like about how many people out, you know, if there's a percentage?
I don't have the exact numbers up to date, but in general, I think that the death summit ratio on Everest is about 1.2 people die for every 100 that summit the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
In context, I think that's about a couple hundred people have died, and more than 5,000 people have successfully climbed it.
Wow.
And you know, I think somebody who's in good physical condition, who has a really experienced guide with them, and has done some other high trekking peaks elsewhere, can have a reasonably good shot at reaching the summit of Everest. But it's not a question of whether you have the physical ability to do it. It's a question of whether you have the experience and the judgment and the guide's experience and judgment to get yourself out of a jam when things go wrong. Because really, it's, you know, it can be all fun and games and good weather and nice when things are going right, but things can turn south and go bad really quickly at that altitude.
Scary stuff. Grayson Schaefer, our senior editor at Outside Magazine, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
More coming up next on 720 WGN. Before the news, real quickly, had some texts about the Everest subject, wondering if that photo, I hope you've seen the photo that's gone viral of the traffic jam. Aleph, have you seen that photo of the traffic jam heading up Everest? It's a shocking one at that.
Yes.
And we know the story is true, but people were wondering, got a few texts about this, saying that they had heard that photo was actually photoshopped, not questioning the truth of whether it was true or not. And according to Snopes, who does their research on this stuff, it isn't. It's a real photo. It looks shocking, and it looks like, I could see why you might think it's Photoshop, but it's a genuine photograph from near the summit of Mount Everest, taken on the 22nd of May, so a week ago today, by Nirmal Purja, who's a mountaineer attempting to climb all 14 of the 8,000-meter, or about 26,000-feet, Himalayan peaks in a single seven-month season.
Wouldn't you hate to go to one of the most remote spots in the world and wait in line?
It's crazy. We make light of it. Obviously, it's a serious story. But yeah, that's what I'm trying to think is, like, man, you're going that far, and you've got to wait 3 hours to get. I can't wait. If there's more than two people in front of me at the Jewels, I huff and puff, let alone a line of 300 people after you've climbed 29,000 feet.
It looks like they're all just standing on a 20,000-foot tightrope.
Right. 29,000.
29,000-foot tightrope.
Just think of that elevation. That's what your airplane mostly flies at, 30,000 feet.
And they have to wait.
And they have to wait.
Ugh.
It's dangerous. 720 WGN, John Hanson in for John Williams on this Wednesday afternoon. Rugby continues to gain popularity across the United States. Not only men's rugby, but women's rugby, too. And we're joined by two people who brave that tough sport, Alev Kelter and Amanda Berta. Guys, thanks for joining us here today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Yeah. So, Alev, we got to start with you. You're born in Alaska.
Yes.
You went to school at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, right?
Yes.
And when did you start playing rugby?
I found rugby after college.
After college?
Yes.
Yeah, you competed in the 2016 Olympics in Rio. How does that story happen? Literally starts with you falling down, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I was recently cut from the ice hockey, national ice hockey team, and was back home snowboarding in Alaska. And I got a phone call from Rick Suggett, who was the Olympic coach at the time, and said, hey, I'd like to fly you out to San Diego and give you a rugby ball and watch you run around for 5 days and see
First
if you
time you had ever touched a rugby ball.
Ever touched a rugby ball.
And, yes. But you had played flag football too, right?
Yes, in high school I did.
So there's similarities except for, you know, all the rules, because it's a completely different sport.
Absolutely, and I get in trouble for calling them rules because they're actually laws nowadays. But
oh, wow.
But there's a lot, and I'm still learning.
Amanda, you're nodding there knowingly. How long have you been playing rugby for?
So similar to Alev, I started later in college, so 3 years now.
Do you think it's picking up in the States, both for men and for women? I mean, we've had, I think the New Zealand teams come to Soldier Field a couple times, and that's always a sight to see, but also with women's teams, too.
Absolutely. I mean, we have a huge Super Series coming up in San Diego. So we have, I think, France, England, New Zealand, and Australia, and Canada coming to California to play in the Caps 15 series. So that's really exciting. That's what I'm looking forward to.
When you say Caps 15, and I saw Cap 7 here on the notes, is that the number of players on each side of the ball? Or?
15s and 7s is the number of players on each side, but capped is just playing for your national team, being suited up in the USA jersey.
So what was that like? I mean, you always had aspirations of going to not only the Summer Olympics, but the Winter and the Summer Olympics, but to finally achieve those dreams, just not in the sport you thought. What
Absolutely.
Was that like?
My dream was, I guess, to, you know, as an 18-year-old, you know, just to make the ice hockey Olympic team and then turn around and play in the soccer Olympics, and then to have it be... rugby was actually a something I never saw coming, but it was a dream come true and unbelievable experience.
I was reading the story about the time you got penalized and then double penalized, or for breaking the laws, I should say, because you're supposed to what? If there's a penalty called?
Yeah, it's similar to soccer. You got to get back 10, and I had no idea there was a back 10 rule. And
see, in football, they take a pause, they move the ball back, and then the referee winds the clock, but it's nothing like that.
No,
you got to run
so
back your own.
In rugby, yeah.
So as you guys get ready for the next set of Summer Olympics, where are you guys at in that qualification pattern?
We are very close to qualifying. Actually, we have our last tournament in Biarritz, France. And all we have to do is actually just show up and be on the field and get 1 point to qualify. So we had that celebration in Canada, although it's not official yet.
Right.
We're looking forward to that. And just hopefully I'll be a part of that squad.
What's it like? I mean, so you guys got fifth in Rio, right?
Yes.
So obviously the goal has got, I mean, obviously the goal is gold medal.
Yes.
Clearly. And
yes.
Do you guys see yourselves as competing for that?
We are sitting number two in the world right now. And so we have an amazing chance to medal. It's just so exciting right now in this process of qualification. And hopefully we'll come away with a lot of points and maybe potentially seat ourselves pretty well for Tokyo 2020.
Amanda, I know in Chicago, you know, as I mentioned, it's growing in popularity. Young men, young women. If there's people out there that are listening and, you know, there's a lot of worries about football being such a contact sport, what do you say to parents who have kids that might want to consider playing rugby? It seems, you know, on the surface to be this very dangerous sort of sport, but I know that you guys might disagree.
So like any contact sport, there's progression. Youth leagues start at flag, so it's not like you're immediately thrown in as a 4 to 6 year old child, like, hey, tackle this
right
human. And then progressions from there into middle school, so you learn proper tackling techniques, and then later into high school and college is when you actually start full contact. And some schools now even require what's called a scrum cap, which is kind of like a mini helmet,
mm-hmm.
Mouth guard always, and shoulder pads. So proper technique and form is first and foremost throughout those younger periods, and then as you get older, you move into a correct form and actual tackling.
Are there a lot of leagues here in the Chicago area?
There's a fair amount of leagues, yes. So I play for the Chicago Women's Lions,
mm-hmm.
and there's also North Shore Rugby, as well as the Barbarians, Suburbs Rugby.
I love that name, the Barbarians.
Yeah,
there you go. not a contact sport at all, the Barbarians.
Yeah. It's really safe. It's
yes.
really safe.
Yeah. No, but I think most importantly, like, any progression through sport, you don't, because you don't wear a helmet, you have to properly learn where to place your head and how to tackle. So unlike football, where you have this illusion of protection,
yeah, yeah.
you have to really work on your form.
And I imagine that there's almost this sense, even though you're competing out there, a sense of a love for the sport. I feel this way in hockey, too, when you play hockey, that there's sort of self-governed rules on how to hit people because you have this love for this sport that's still growing. And there's almost this sense of, we have to keep this as safe as possible and hit in the proper way, or, you know, tackle or scrum in the proper way in order to keep that sport moving forward. I don't know if you guys feel that on the field or not. That might just, or is it a pitch? I don't even know. What's
it's
it called?
Pitch.
It's a pitch.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
There we go.
No, I think in hockey, you know, you get a lot of flack for, heckling the ref.
Right.
And that's so different when it comes to rugby, because there is one person, a madam or sir, and they are, you know, held to the utmost regard, because that is our safety on the line. And that is, you know, basically you can't heckle the ref. You literally, it's what they say goes. And that's for our safety. And so that's the respect of the game. You know, it's, they call it a gentleman's sport and whatever that means right nowadays, but it means it's just respectful, to not only the ref, but to each other. And it is an all out battle, but at the end of the day, we are best friends and we will go and have fun afterwards.
We've had Title IX in the United States for so many years, but
Ted Stevens, woo-woo.
Right. Exactly. Out of Senator, former yes. Senator from Alaska,
yes.
Of course. But I think that there still is obviously this push for, I don't want to say push for equality. That seems so like a throwaway line, but just a push to know that women's teams are as competitive as men's teams out there,
yep.
And that we continue to kind of break down the mold for younger children and yep. as they grow up, that look, really, the door, we're not just saying this is not just mouthpiece, the door is open for you to try anything that your boy counterparts want to try. So as you guys go to abroad,
yeah, it's the same size pitch, same size ball, we can hit the same, and it's not different than the men's game, which I think is phenomenal coming from hockey and soccer, where there's a little bit of a stigma of the differences.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you were to sit down and watch a women's game, you'd be just as impressed.
So as you, oh, I'm sure. And as we get ready for Tokyo 2020, and again, you guys got to show up on the pitch first, and you guys will do that, of course, you'll qualify. What's the next year look like as you get ready?
Well, we actually talk about, equality. We joined eight stops next year. We had six stops this year around the world. We'll have six of those eight paired with the men. And we added a Hong Kong stop, a Wellington stop, and a South Africa stop.
Interesting.
So we're excited. We have we won't have qualification processes, so we'll just really try to see what best team has the best, the most chemistry, and then kind of solidify that group maybe six months out.
Eagle River, Alaska. So I know Eagle River, Wisconsin, having gone there. I'm sure many of our listeners do. I see you got the map there of Alaska on your hat. Where is Eagle River, Alaska at?
It's about 15 minutes north of Anchorage.
Okay. Yep. I still don't know where that is. You could have
Anchorage
said
is the biggest city, and I'm like going to show you with my hand,
okay,
but it's
there
right
it is.
Here.
All right. Yeah, we do that with Michigan a lot, with the glove and the boot and
yep.
that sort of thing. Where, if people want more information on what you guys do, or other leagues here in Chicago or the Chicago area, where can people even start to look?
I think the first place you'd want to go is to usarugby.org. They have a great site where you can go in and say, hey, I live in this area, and it'll spit out every team that's registered with USA Rugby, which you have to be.
Mm-hmm.
You have something called SIPT, which means that you're covered under USA Rugby insurance, and all the legal stuff is mm-hmm. kind of taken care of. So usarugby.org, go ahead, put in your find a team. I think that's the name of
that's
the tab.
That's the easy way to do it. Yeah.
Yeah, go in, put your location.
All right, Aleva, as we break on up here, is there like something you do when you guys break, I don't want to say the scrum, but with your own team, do you have like a chant or anything?
I mean,
you guys...
simple USA on three is probably where we're at.
Let's do it. All right, ready?
All right, USA on three. One, two, three.
USA. Guys, thanks for joining us. All right, that was fascinating. They stopped by a couple hours ago. They got a busy schedule today. But Elif, you know Alev.
Yes.
She's sort of your cousin, right?
So, not by blood, but I was just trying to draw a family tree for myself. But here's what I know. My cousin, Daria, is married to a man named Osman. And she is Osman's third generation cousin.
Okay.
He was saying that his grandma was Alev's cousin. And then he followed that up with, my dad is her mom's cousin. And I am her cousin. So I'm like,
you have no idea.
I am lost.
You are. I am. We all are. But did you know that she? Did you know that she existed? One, that she was a rugby player, because you guys went out for dinner the other night, right?
We did. We had a drink together. I knew she existed from my nephew who idolizes her,
uh-huh.
And I'm like, okay. Well, I'm in radio, so
right. So then you're like, this is an interesting person. Let's talk to her.
Yeah, yeah.
So she just would have been a normal cousin that didn't play rugby on the women's Olympic team. You would have never met for a drink with her.
Well, no.
Okay.
I love family.
Okay.
So Either way, I mean, the star power definitely adds to the allure. But anyway, I heard about her from my 12-year-old nephew who loves soccer and rugby and sports. And the way that she described her meeting my nephew was he slid into my DMs.
But they're related then, right?
They're related.
So there's nothing nefarious about it.
Through his dad.
Okay.
Through my nephew's dad.
Well, she was really interesting. And rugby, you know, I had to ask about the safety. Because for me, when I watch rugby, and I know some people that play rugby that have gotten hurt, you know, broken bones here or there or gashes on their face. But I don't know of the stats of concussions or what you're talking about for brain injuries. But then she brought up the point, and so did a texter while the interview was going on, the idea that the illusion of safety, like what you have with football, with pads and a helmet, and certainly you had before the last decade, is worse than seeing people tackle each other in proper form. Because the fact that you know that you don't have a helmet, neither does the other person, you're not leading with the crown of your head like some football players do, even though they're told not to. You just do it naturally because you feel like you're protected up there without knowing, you know, inner workings, what's happening and with the spine and that sort of thing. So, I mean, I believe it. I just don't have the stats in front of me to back it up. So, would you let if you had children, would you let your children play rugby?
I don't know. I wouldn't let them play football,
right?
Though.
Yeah,
so I don't think.
I don't think I would either. And I grew up with two brothers who went on to be all-state and collegiate football players, and I don't think there's a chance I'd let my kid play football. I don't know about rugby. I think I would. I hate to say it right after they did the interview. I think I would. I'd have to look more into it. It certainly looks like a kind of a vicious sport. But again, it's cool.
I think it's cool.
They certainly are the most rambunctious group of people ever. They like their team bonds in rugby are tight. I don't know if you've ever seen like videos of the pranks that they do or the fun things that they do about town. Have you or no?
No.
You'll want to look that
up. Tell me about it.
During the commercial break here on 720 WGN. WGN, John Hanson in for John Williams, just for a little bit longer. Rowan Anna coming up in just a little bit. You know, that Mount Everest story, and I know, I think Roe's going to be tackling that in a little bit. I think he's talking to a climber, a Chicago climber, who made it up and down recently, right, Elif? I think that...
Yes. His name is Alexander Panko.
Well, I got to tune in for that. That's going to be fascinating. Here's the thing, is I think that there's a certain type of person that it takes to want to climb Mount Everest, and I'm not even in that conversation. So it's a hard thing for me to, you know, kind of break down and determine whether I would do it or not. Would you ever climb Mount Everest if given the chance? Let's say money wasn't an object and you had that opportunity to do it. You'd still have to go through all the work and all that. Would that be something you'd want to do?
No, just because that's not one of my goals. But
right.
I can see why people want to do
that. Yeah, I see the appeal, like conquering the tallest mountain. Lauren Lapka, you were telling me during the break that you've done some climbing. High altitude stuff too, right?
Yeah, I think the highest I've done. Now, I didn't do the full mountain, but I went towards the top and climbed the top. And a lot of times, just the battle is being up that high. It was a little more than 14,000 feet.
Oh, wow.
Mount Evans in Colorado. A lot of people start to get very dizzy, obviously can't breathe. And it doesn't seem to
even at 14,000 feet, really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah. So I think that is a natural gift. I don't know why it doesn't affect me too much. So I do enjoy hiking a lot, and I do enjoy mountains and beautiful scenery. So I would like to think that it's something I would go for if money wasn't an object and if I had all the time in the world. But yeah, that's the problem, you know, money and then investing the time to prepare properly. You know, I would not want to rely on some Sherpa to, you know, save my life in a situation like that.
Well, right. And I feel for these people that go up to the top of the mountain or they get really, really close to the top of it and then they see that long line. But like, once you get that far, I feel like once you get to 28,900, you're going the last 100 no matter what.
Yeah, I feel bad for the people that really did invest all the right time to prepare that are getting stuck by those probably less prepared.
Yeah. I'm kind of curious by people, 312-981-7200. You know, I don't know if it's Mount Everest or, you know, everyone kind of has that I don't know, maybe not everyone. I was trying to think on my bucket list if there's any like natural resource or thing or natural wonder of the world that I would want to venture to, whether it's swimming the Great Barrier Reef or something. And
I've done that and it's beautiful, but you got to go quick because everything's starting to turn around.
Yeah, you've only got a couple more years, maybe. You sound adventurous, Lauren.
Yes, I would say I'm very fortunate to be quite well traveled for my age.
Yeah, because I've seen some of your Facebook posts when you were out west, and you do everything.
Yeah, a big outdoorsy fan. So when I was in Oregon, it was great because I could leave work and then go hike a decent-sized mountain, maybe about like 1,200 feet, just 15 minutes from where I worked.
Wow.
There's just all kinds of things to do out there in Oregon. But I have also traveled to Australia and South Africa, and I have studied abroad in China. So a little bit of everything. I think it's very important to experience different things and cultures. It's one of my favorite things to do, actually.
So I want an honest answer, Lauren, okay?
Okay.
So I would never, I mean, I've gone hiking. I've seen some of the beauties of the world and I studied abroad and it was great. And I drank my wine way through Italy and experienced it all. And I agree with the traveling thing. But in terms of like adventuresome sort of things, it just isn't my cup of tea. I don't think I would do it. I get nervous on certain things. Mm-hmm. Do you, as someone who's outdoorsy and adventure-y, do you judge people like me?
No, not at all.
Really? There's not even like a, oh gosh, this guy can't even do this or wouldn't even try to do this.
No, because there's plenty of things that I don't like to do and people love to do. Everyone has their niche, right?
Mm-hmm.
Niche, however you want to say it.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I just always picture people, maybe I'm just always concerned about that, but people being like, oh, that guy's like, if we're a bunch of, we're with a bunch of friends in San Francisco. I forget where even the hill is. It's probably not even that big. I mean, San Francisco is very hilly, but there's one particular perch that you kind of got to climb up. And I think I was with 10 friends and 9 of them did it. And I was the one that was like, I'm going to go to this bar instead and sit here and have a beer.
Well,
I figured they talked about me the whole way up. I don't know.
No, one of my favorite things about it, and I think a lot of people can relate, is the reason a lot of people like to hike and do things like that is it's an excuse not to go to the gym.
True.
I hate working out and I know it's good for me and all that. So by doing something like that, I'm getting in a workout without that.
Yeah. See, I'm going to go home after this and run 9 miles on the treadmill. So there you go.
Yeah. See, that sounds awful.
See, that to me is peaceful. Just turn on the music and run and then you don't got to worry about outside or nature or anything like that. Anyways, thanks,
Lauren. Exactly. Perfect example.
Someone chimed in. They just did a 0.4, so just under a half a mile climb at Devil's Lake, Wisconsin, with only one path up or down. And even that was crazy, coordinating when to go or when to wait, kind of relating to what's happening at the top of Mount Everest. Okay, we're going to take a quick commercial break. After that, the stories that matter with Kim Gordon in the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom here on 720 WGN. Okay, cleaning up a few things here. The 630 texted in, my son played lacrosse, hockey, and football. His only concussions were from falling off his bike, ice skating with friends, and skiing. Doesn't sound like a good combination there, but so let your friends play, or let your kids, excuse me, play whatever sport they want. That's okay. I get that. I totally understand. Still, football is the one that scares me. And then the 630 said that the one thing that they would conquer and risk life or limb for was Machu Picchu. Okay. That was from the 630. I can hear Justin Coffin and Anna Vlantes. How are you guys doing this afternoon?
Good, John.
Just another quiet, calm day. Nothing happened nationally.
First city council meeting
after
she banged the gavel for the very first time, Mayor Lightfoot. Well, she got into it, right, with Alderman Burke.
Yeah.
There was some, it was pretty fiery.
It was also strange what Burke was trying to raise ire about. He was trying to talk about the pronoun thing, right?
Right, like gender-neutral terms, and he was pretty much, it came across as if a power move that she very quickly swatted away.
Was he just trying to get in the door with something that everyone can agree on so he could have a platform to speak? I don't know what he was getting
at. I think it was a direct hit, and I think she called that out pretty clearly that this is something she's had the tussles with him in the past, that it's sort of, he'll bring up things like this to sort of question things and
for anyone, and Anna knows this and you know this too, John, but Alderman Burke can be a stickler on a lot of different things. And if you have ever been to a city council meeting, he uses a lot of the air in the room to talk about whatever he wants to talk about ad nauseum. Mm-hmm. So,
but I think it's purposeful in a lot of moves. There's an agenda behind it.
Burke.
It isn't sort of a, let me just bring up some things on my mind, kind of airy-fairy sort of thing. And I think she called it out and she told him to sit down and I'll call upon you when I want to hear from you, which I'm not sure we've heard that ever, those words ever spoken to Alderman
Burke. And a whole city rose to its feet.
Yes.
There were some applause. And we have the replacement, by the way, for Alderman Burke on the Finance Committee.
Yeah.
Wagus back will be joining Justin and I as Rose off today. He'll be talking about his new responsibilities and the first day for City Council and this ambitious agenda. 100 days this mayor is giving to really put in some reforms that I think would be popular to the public, and we'll see how much resistance she gets.
Yeah, it's incredible how, you know, the aldermanic control thing, she's navigated through that pretty well, got her slate of committeemen and women that she wanted, and
she did.
We'll see where we go from there. Have a good show, guys.
Thank you.
We'll
also talk to a man who just returned from Everest, and we're going to play News or Ruse coming up as
well.
Love
it. What a show.